gods utterly content, knowing in their hearts that they had done a greater thing than they at first knew, and never again would Valinor see such ages as had passed. And Vana said that Colulin's fount was dulled, and her garden wilted in the heat, and her roses lost their hues and fragrance, for the sun then sailed nearer to the earth than it now does. Then Manwë chid them for their fickleness and discontent, but they were not appeased, and suddenly spake Ulmo, coming from outer Vi, "Lord Manwë, neither are their counsels nor thine to be despised. Have ye then not yet understood, O Valar, wherein lay much of the great beauty of the trees of old? In change, and in slow alternation of fair things, the passing blending sweetly with that which was to come." But Lorien said suddenly, "O Valaturu, the Lord of Vi speaketh words wiser than ever before, and they fill me with a great longing." And he left them thereupon, and went out upon the plain, and it was then 3 daytimes, which is the length of 3 blossomings of Laurelin of old, since the ship of mourning was unmoored. Then for 4 daytimes more sat Lorien beside the stock of Silpion, and the shadows gathered shyly round him, for the sun was far to the east, beating about the heavens where it listed, since Manwë had not as yet ruled its course, and Urwendi was bidden fair as seemed good to her. Yet even so Lorien is not appeased, not though the darkness of the mountains creep across the plain, and the mist bloweth in from off the sea, and a vague and flitting twilight gathers once more in Valinor. But long he sits, pondering why the spells of Yavanna wrought only upon Laurelin. Editor's note. Then Lorien sang to Silpion, saying that the Valar were lost in a wilderness of gold and heat, or else in shadows full of death and unkindly glooms, and he touched the wound in the bole of the tree. End of editor's note. Lo, even as he touched that cruel hurt, a light glowed faintly there, as if radiant sap still stirred within. But a low branch above Lorien's bowed head burgeoned suddenly, and leaves of a very dark green, long and oval, budded and unfolded upon it. Yet was all the tree beside, bare and dead, and has ever been so since. Now it was at that time 7 times 7 days since the fruit of noon was born upon Laurelin, and many of the Eldar and of the sprites and of the gods were drawn nigh, listening to Lorien's song. But he heeded them not, gazing upon the tree. Lo, its new leaves were crusted with a silver moisture, and their undersides were white and set with pale gleaming filaments. Buds there were of flowers also upon the bough, and they opened, but a dark mist of the sea gathered about the tree, and the air grew bitterly cold, as it never before had been in Valinor, and those blossoms faded and fell, and none heeded them. One only was there at the branch's end. That opening shone of its own light, and no mist or cold harmed it, but indeed waxing it seemed to suck the very vapours and transform them subtly to the silver substance of its body, and it grew to be a very pale and wondrous glistering flower, nor did even the purest snow upon Taniquetil, gleaming in the light of Silpion out, rival it, and its heart was of white flame, and it throbbed, waxing and waning marvellously. Then said Lorien, for the joy of his heart, "Behold, the rose of Silpion." And that rose grew till the fruit of Laurelin had been but little greater, and 10,000 crystal petals were in that flower, and it was drenched in a fragrant dew like honey, and this dew was light. Now Lorien would suffer none to draw near, and this will he rue for ever, for the branch upon which the rose hung yielded all its sap and withered, nor even yet would he suffer that blossom to be plucked gently down, being enamoured of its loveliness, and lusting to see it grow mightier than the fruit of noon, more glorious than the sun. Then snapped the withered bough, and the rose of Silpion fell, and some of its dewy light was roughly shaken from it, and here and there a petal was crushed and tarnished, and Lorien cried aloud, and sought to lift it gently up, but it was too great. Therefore did the gods let send to Ale's halls, for there was a great silver charger, like to a table of the giants, and they set the latest bloom of Silpion upon it, and despite its hurts, its glory and fragrance and pale magic were very great indeed. Now when Lorien had mastered his grief and ruth, he spake the counsel that Ulmo's words had called to his heart, that the gods build another vessel to match the galleon of the sun, and it shall be made from the rose of Silpion, said he, and in memory of the waxing and waning of these trees for 12 hours, shall the sunship sail the heavens and leave Valinor, and for 12 shall Silpion's pale bark mount the skies, and there shall be rest for tired eyes and weary hearts. This, then, was the manner of the shaping of the moon, for Aule would not dismember the loveliness of the rose of silver, and he called rather to him certain of those Eldar of his household who were of the Noldali of old, note 15, and had consorted with the jewel-makers. Now these revealed to him much store of crystals and delicate glasses that Feanor and his sons, note 16, had laid up in secret places in Sir Numen, and with the aid of those elves and of Varda of the stars, who gave even of the light of those frail boats of hers to give limpid clearness to their fashioning, he brought to being a substance thin as a petal of a rose, clear as the most transparent elfin glass, and very smooth, yet might Aule of his skill bend it and fashion it, and naming it, he called it Virin. Of Virin now he built a marvellous vessel, and often have men spoken of the ship of the moon, yet is it scarce like to any bark that sailed or sea or air. Rather was it like an island of pure glass, albeit not very great, and tiny lakes there were bordered with snowy flowers that shone, for the water of those pools that gave them sap was the radiance of Telimpe. Midmost of that shimmering isle was wrought a cup of that crystalline stuff that Aule made, and therein the magic rose was set, and the glassy body of the vessel sparkled wonderfully as it gleamed therein. Rods there were, and perchance they were of ice, and they rose upon it like airy masts, and sails were caught to them by slender threads, and Weenan wove them of white mists and foam, and some were sprent with glinting scales of silver fish, some threaded with tiniest stars like points of light, sparks caught in snow when Yelwyn was shining. Thus was the ship of the moon, the crystal island of the rose, and the gods named it Rana, the moon, but the fairies, Sil, the rose, note 17, and many a sweet name beside. Il Salunte, or the silver shallop, has it been called, and thereto the gnomes have called it Minethlos, or the argent isle, and Krithoskaleg, the disk of glass. Now Silmo begged to sail upon the oceans of the firmament therein, but he might not, for neither was he of the children of the air, nor might he find a way to cleanse his being of its earthwardness, as had Urwendi, note 18, done, and little would it have availed to enter Fascalan, had he dared assay it, for then would Rana have shriveled before him. Manwe bade therefore Ilinsor, a spirit of the Suruli, who loved the snows and the starlight, and aided Varda in many of her works, to pilot this strange gleaming boat. And with him went many another spirit of the air, arrayed in robes of silver and white, or else of palest gold. But an aged elf with hoary locks stepped upon the moon unseen, and hid him in the rose, and there dwells he ever since, and tends that flower. And a little white turret has he builded on the moon, where often he climbs and watches the heaven, or the world beneath, and that is Wole Kuvion, who sleepeth never. Some indeed have named him the Man in the Moon, but Ilinsor is it rather who hunts the stars. Now is to tell how the plan that Lorien devised was changed, for the white radiance of Silpion is by no means so buoyant and ethereal as is the flame of Laurelin, nor Virin so little weighty as the rind of the bright fruit of noon. And when the gods laded the white ship with light and would launch it upon the heavens, behold, it would not rise above their heads. Moreover, behold, that living rose continued to give forth a honey as of light that distills upon the isle of glass, and a dew of moonbeams glistens there, yet rather does this weigh the vessel than buoy it, as did the increase of the sunship's flames. So is it that Ilinsor must return at times, and that overflowing radiance of the rose is stored in Valinor against dark days. And it is to tell that such days come ever and anon, for then the white flower of the isle wanes and scarcely shines, and then must it be refreshed and watered with its silver dew, much as Silpion was wont of old to be. Hence was it that a pool was builded hard by the dark southern wall of Valmar, and of silver and white marbles were its walls, but dark yews shut it in, being planted in a maze most intricate about it. There Lorien hoarded the pale dewy light of that fair rose, and he named it the Lake Irtinsa. So comes it that for 14 nights men may see Rana's bark float upon the airs, and for other 14 the heavens know it not, while even on those fair nights when Rana fares abroad, it showeth not ever the same aspect as doth Sari the Glorious, for whereas that bright galleon voyageth, even above Ilwe and beyond the stars, and cleaveth a dazzling way blinding the heavens, highest of all things, recking little of winds or motion of the airs, yet Ilinsor's bark is heavier and less filled with magic and with power, and fareth never above the skies, but saileth in the lower folds of Ilwe, threading a white swath among the stars. For this reason the high winds trouble it at times, tugging at its misty shrouds, and often are these torn and scattered, and the gods renew them. At times, too, are the petals of the rose ruffled, and its white flames blown hither and thither, like a silver candle guttering in the wind. Then doth Rana heave and toss about the air, as often you may see him, and mark the slender curve of his bright keel, his prow now dipping, now his stern, and whiles again he sails serenely to the west, and up through the pure lucency of his frame, the wide rose of Silpion is seen, and some say the aged form of Wole Kuvion beside. Then indeed is the ship of the moon very fair to look upon, and the earth is filled with slender lights, and deep quick-moving shadows, and radiant dreams go with cool wings about the world, but Lorien has ruth amid his gladness, because his flower bears yet, and will forever, the faint marks of its bruising and its fall, and all men can see them clearly. But, note 19, lo, saith Lindo, I run on ahead, for yet have I only told that the silver ship is newly built, and Ilinsor yet but first stepped aboard, and now do the gods draw that vessel once again up the steep sides of old Taniquetil, singing as they go songs of Lorien's folk that long have been dumb in Valinor. Slower was that wayfaring than the lifting of the ship of morn, and all the folk strain lustily at the ropes, until Orome, coming, harnesses thereto a herd of wild white horses, and thus comes the vessel to the topmost place. Then behold, the galleon of the sun is seen afar, beating golden from the east, and the Valar marvel to descry the glowing peaks of many a mountain far away, and isles glimmering green in seas once dark. Then cried Osse, Look, O Manwe, but the sea is blue, as blue well nigh as Ilwe that thou lovest. And nay, said Manwe, envy we not Ilwe, for the sea is not blue alone, but grey and green and purple, and most beauteous flowered with foaming white. Nor jade, nor amethyst, nor porphyry, set with diamonds and with pearls, outrival the waters of the great and little seas when the sunlight drenches them. So saying, Manwe sent Fionwe, his son, swiftest of all, to move about the airs, and bade him say to Urwendi that the bark of the sun come back a while to Valinor, for the gods have counsels for her ear. And Fionwe fled most readily, for he had conceived a great love for that bright maiden long ago, and her loveliness now, when bathed in fire she sat as the radiant mistress of the sun, set him aflame with the eagerness of the gods. So was it that Urwendi brought her ship unwilling above Valinor, and Orome cast a noose of gold about it, and it was drawn slowly down upon the earth, and behold, the woods upon Taniquetil glowed once more in the mingled light of silver and gold, and all were minded of the ancient blending of the trees. But Ilsalunte paled before the galleon of the sun, till almost it seemed to burn no more. So ended the first day upon the world, and it was very long, and full of many marvellous deeds that Gilfanon may tell. But now the gods beheld the evening deepen over the world, as the sunship was drawn down, and the glow upon the mountains faded, and the sparkle of the seas went out. Then the primeval darkness crept out again once more from many stealthy lairs, but Varda was glad to see the steady shining of the stars. Far upon the plain was Sari drawn, and when she was gone Ilsalunte was hailed upon the topmost peak, so that his white lucency fell out thence over the wide world, and the first night was come. Indeed, in these days, darkness is no more within the borders of the world, but only night, and night is another and a different thing, by reason of the rose of Silpion. Now, however, does Aule fill the brimming vessel of that flower with white radiance, and many of the suruli, white-winged, glide beneath, and bear it slowly up, and set it among the company of the stars. There does it swim slowly, a pale and glorious thing, and Ilinsor and his comrades sit them upon its rim, and with shimmering oars urge it bravely through the sky. And Manwë breathed upon its bellying sails, till it was wafted far away, and the beat of the unseen oars against the winds of night faded and grew faint. Of this manner was the first rising of the moon about Taniquetil, and Lórien rejoiced, but Ilinsor was jealous of the supremacy of the sun, and he bade the starry mariners flee before him, and the constellate lamps go out, but many would not, and often he set sail in chase of them, and the little ships of Varda fled before the huntsmen of the firmament, and were not caught. And that, said Lindo, is all, methinks, I know to tell, of the building of those marvellous ships, and their launching on the air. Note 20. But, said Ariel, nay, surely that is not so, for at the tale's beginning, methought you promised us words concerning the present courses of the sun and moon, and their rising in the east, and I, for one, by the leave of the others here present, am not minded to release you of your word. Then quoth Lindo, laughing, nay, I remember not the promise. And did I make it, then it was rash indeed, for the things you ask are no wise easy to relate, and many matters concerning the deeds in those days in Valinor are hidden from all, save only the Valar. Now, however, am I fain rather to listen, and thou, Vire, perchance, will take up the burden of the tale. Thereat did all rejoice, and the children clapped their hands, for dearly did they love those times when Vire was the teller of the tale. But Vire said, lo, tales I tell of the deep days, and the first is called The Hiding of Valinor. Notes. 1. The manuscript has here Gylfan a Davrobel, but in the rejected earlier version of this passage, the reading is Gylfanan a Davrobel, suggesting that Gylfan was not intentional. Note 2. See The Cottage of Lost Play, side 1, on the relation of Tavrobel to the Staffordshire village of Great Heywood. At Great Heywood, the River Sow joins the Trent. 3. In the rejected version of this interlude, Gylfanan's history is differently recounted. He was long before an Ilkorin and had dwelt ages back in Hisilome. He came to Tol Eressëa after the Great March, i.e. Inwë's March into the world, the Great Expedition from Kor, see The Cottage of Lost Play, side 1, for he had adopted blood kinship with the Noldoli. This is the first occurrence of the term Ilkorin, which refers to elves who are not of Kor. Compare the later term Umanyar, elves not of Aman. Arkanor is the precursor of Doriath. 4. Gylfanan, a gnome, is here called the oldest of the fairies. See The Music of the Ainur, side 2. 5. No explanation of the House of the Hundred Chimneys near the bridge of Tavrobel is known to me, but I have never visited Great Heywood, and it may be that there was or is a house there that gave rise to it. 6. The rejected form of the interlude is quite different in its latter part. Therefore, said Lindo in answer to Ariel, behold, Gylfanan here can tell you much of such matters, but first of all must you be told of the deeds that were done in Valinor when Melko slew the trees and the gnomes marched away into the darkness. 'Tis a long tale, but well worth the hearkening. For Lindo loved to tell such tales, and sought often an occasion for recalling them. But Gylfanan said, speak on, my Lindo, but methinks the tale will not be told tonight or for many a night after, and I shall have fared long back to Tavrobel. Nay, said Lindo, I will not make the tale over long, and tomorrow shall be all your own. And so saying, Gilfanon sighed, but Lindo lifted up his voice. 7. Lest it be. This curious expression is clear in the manuscript. The usage seems wholly unrecorded, but the meaning intended must be, unless it be, that is, to him alone, unless also to Varda. 8. On Telimpe, as the name of the moon cauldron rather than Cylindrin, see The Coming of the Valar, side 3, and The Coming of the Elves, side 5, note 2. 9. See The Coming of the Valar, side 3 and 4. At previous occurrences, the name is Urwen, not Urwendi. 10. Twixt Erumani and the sea, i.e. the outer sea, Vi, the western bound of Valinor. 11. The passage beginning, For behold, he desired in this manner, and continuing to this point, was added on a detached sheet, and replaced a very much shorter passage, in which Manwë briefly declared his plan, and nothing was said about the powers of the Valar, but I do not think that the replacement was composed significantly later than the body of the text. 12. The earlier reading here was, Then did the gods name that ship, and they called her Ur, which is the sun, etc. 13. The earlier reading here was, And the gnomes called her Aur, the sun, and Galmir, the gold gleamer, etc. 14. An isolated note refers to the coming forth of more wholesome creatures when the sun arose, i.e. over the great lands, and says that all the birds sang in the first dawn. 15. The Aulanosse. 16. This is the first appearance of the sons of Feanor. 17. Earlier reading, The Silver Rose. 18. Urwendi. Manuscript, Urwandi, but I think that this was probably unintended. 19. From this point, the text of the Tale of the Sun and Moon ceases to be written over an erased, penciled original, and from the same point, the original text is extant in another book. In fact, to the end of the Tale of the Sun and Moon, the differences are slight, no more than alterations of wording, but the original text does explain the fact that at the first occurrence of the name Gilfanon, the original reading was Ilios. One would guess, in any case, that this was a slip, a reversion to an earlier name, and that this is so is shown by the first version, which has, For many marvellous deeds that Gilfanon may tell, many marvellous deeds as Ilios shall tell. 20. From this point, the second version diverges sharply from the first. The first reads as follows, And that is all, methinks, said Lindo, that I know to tell of those fairest works of the gods. But Ilios said, Little doth it cost thee to spin the tale, an it be of Valinor. It is a while since ye offered us a tale concerning the rising of the sun and moon in the east, and a flow of speech has poured from thee since then, but now art thou minded to tease, and no word of that promise. Of a truth, Ilios, beneath his roughness, liked the words of Lindo as well as any, and he was eager to learn of the matter. That is easy told, said Lindo. What follows in the original version relates to the matter of the next chapter. See The Hiding of the Valinor, side 8. Ilios here claims that a promise made by Lindo has not been fulfilled, just as does Ariel more politely in the second version. The beginning of the tale in the first version is not extant, and perhaps, as it was originally written, Lindo did make this promise. But in the second, he says no such thing. Indeed, Ariel's question was, Whence be the sun and moon? And at the end of his tale denies that he had done so when Ariel asserts it. Changes made to names in the Tale of the Sun and Moon. Amnor, capital A-M-N-O-R, changed from Amnos. Amnos is the form in the flight of the Noldoli, changed from M-non. The form Amnon, capital A-M-N-O-N, also occurs, see side 6. For changes in the passage on the names of the sun, see notes 12 and 13. Gilfanon, capital G-I-L-F-A-N-O-N, changed from Ilios, capital A-I-L-I-O-S, at the first occurrence only. See note 19. Minethlos, capital M-I-N-E-T-H-L-O-S, changed from Minelos, capital M-A-I-N-L-O-S. Uolekuvion, capital U-O-L-E, capital K-U-V-I-O-N, changed from Uole Mikumi, capital M-I-K-U-M-I, only at the second occurrence. At the first occurrence, Uole Mikumi was left unchanged, though I have given Uole Kuvion in the text. Ship of Mourning changed from Kalavente, capital K-A-L-A-V-E-N-T-E. I Kalavente, the Ship of Light, occurs unamended in the text. The Sunship's Flames changed from the Flames of Kalavente. Sari, capital S-A-R-I, changed from Kalavene, capital K-A-L-A-V-E-N-E. Kalavene is the form in the original version. See note 19. Commentary on the Tale of the Sun and Moon. The effect of the opening of this tale is undoubtedly to emphasize more strongly than in the later accounts the horror aroused by the deeds of the Nolali. Notable is Aule's bitterness against them, of which nothing is said afterwards, and also the finality and absoluteness of their exclusion from Valinor. But the idea that some gnomes remained in Valinor, the Aulanasse, survived. Compare the Silmarillion, page 84. And of all the Noldor in Valinor, who were grown now to a great people, but one tithe refused to take the road, some for the love that they bore to the Valar, and to Aule not least, some for the love of Tirion and the many things that they had made, none for fear of peril by the way. Sorontua's mission and the tidings that he brought back were to be abandoned. Very striking is his account of the empty ships drifting, of which some were burning with bright fires. The origin of Feanor's burning of the ships of the Teleri at Losgar in the Silmarillion, page 90, where, however, there is more evident reason for doing so. That Melko's second dwelling place in the Great Lands was distinct from Utumna is here expressly stated, as also that it was in the Iron Mountains. Compare the Theft of Melko, side 6. The name Angamandi, Hells of Iron, has occurred once in the Lost Tales, in the very strange account of the fate of men after death, the coming of the Valar, side 3. In later accounts, Angband was built on the site of Utumno, but finally they were separated again, and in the Silmarillion, Angband had existed from ancient days before the captivity of Melkor, the music of the Ainur, side 2. It is not explained in the present tale why nevermore will Utumna open to him, but doubtless it was because Tulkas and Ulmo broke its gates and piled hills of stone upon them, the chaining of Melko, side 4. In the next part of the tale, much light is cast on my father's early conception of the powers and limitations of the great Valar. Thus, Yavanna and Manwë, brought to this realization by Yavanna, are shown to believe that the Valar have done ill, or at least failed to achieve the wider designs of Ilúvatar. I have it in mind that this time of darkness is not without the desire of Ilúvatar. The idea of selfish, inward-looking gods is plainly expressed. Gods content to tend their gardens and devise their devisings behind their mountains, leaving the world to shape itself as it may. And this realization is an essential element in their conceiving the making of the sun and moon, which are to be such bodies as may light not only the blessed realms, an expression which occurs here for the first time, but all the rest of the dark earth. Of all this there is only a trace in the Silmarillion, page 99. These things the Valar did, recalling in their twilight the darkness of the lands of Arda, and they resolved now to illumine Middle-earth and with light to hinder the deeds of Melkor. Of much interest also is the theological statement in the early narrative concerning the binding of the Valar to the world as the condition of their entering it. Compare the Silmarillion, page 20. But this condition Ilúvatar made, or it is the necessity of their love, that their power should thenceforward be contained and bounded in the world, to be within it forever until it is complete, so that they are its life and it is theirs. In the tale, this condition is an express physical limitation. None of the Valar, save Manwë and Varda and their attendant spirits, could pass into the higher airs above Vilna, though they could move at great speed within the lowest air. From the passage where it is said that Ulmo, despite his love for the Solosimpi and grief at the kinslaying, was yet not filled with anger against the Noldoli, for he was for knowing more than all the gods, even than great Manwe, it is seen that Ulmo's peculiar concern for the exiled Eldar, which plays such an important if mysterious part in the development of the story, was there from the beginning, as also was Yavanna's thought, expressed in the Silmarillion, page 78. Even for those who are mightiest under Ilúvatar, there is some work that they may accomplish once and once only. The light of the trees I brought into being, and within Ea I can do so never again. Yavanna's reference to the magic sun and its relighting, which has appeared in the toast drunk in the evening in the cottage of Lost Play, side 1, and the coming of the Valar, side 3, is obviously intended to be obscure at this stage. There is no later reference to the story of the wastage of light by Lórien and Vanna, pouring it over the roots of the trees unavailingly. Turning to Lindo's account of the stars, Morwynion has appeared in an earlier tale, The Coming of the Elves, side 4, with the story that Varda dropped it as she fared in great haste back to Valinor, and that it blazes above the world's edge in the west. In the present tale, Morwynion, which, according to both the Kenya and Gnomish word lists, is Arcturus, is again strangely represented as being a luminary always of the western sky. It is said here that while some of the stars were guided by the Manir and the Suruli on mazy courses, others, including Morwynion and Yelwyn, abode where they hung and moved not. Is the explanation of this that in the ancient myths of the elves there was a time when the regular apparent movement of all the heavenly bodies from east to west had not yet begun? This movement is nowhere explained mythically in my father's cosmology. Nielwyn, Blue Bee, is Sirius, in the Silmarillion called Helwyn, and this star had a place in the legend of Telemektar, son of Tulkas, though the story of his conversion into the constellation of Orion was never clearly told. Compare Telumechtar, Orion, in The Lord of the Rings, Appendix E. 1. Nielwyn was Inwe's son Ingil, who followed Telemektar in the likeness of a great bee bearing honey of flame. See the appendix on names under Ingil and Telemektar. The course of the sun and moon between east and west, rather than in some other direction, is here given a rationale, and the reason for avoiding the south is Ungweliant's presence there. This seems to give Ungweliant a great importance, and also a vast area subject to her power of absorbing light. It is not made clear in the tale of the darkening of Valinor where her dwelling was. It is said, The Theft of Melko, side 6, that Melko wandered the dark plains of Eruman and farther south than anyone yet had penetrated. He found a region of the deepest gloom, a region where he found the cavern of Ungweliant, which had a subterranean outlet on the sea. And after the destruction of the trees, Ungweliant gets her gone southward and over the mountains to her home. The Theft of Melko, side 6. It is impossible to tell from the vague lines on the little map, The Coming of the Valar, side 3, what was at this time the configuration of the southern lands and seas. In comparison with the last part of the tale, concerning the last fruit of Laurelin and the last flower of Silpion, the making from them of the sun and moon and the launching of their vessels, chapter 11 of the Silmarillion, constituted from two later versions, not greatly dissimilar the one from the other, is extremely brief. Despite many differences, the later versions read in places almost as summaries of the early story, but it is often hard to say whether the shortening depends rather on my father's feeling, certainly present, that the description was too long, was taking too large a place in the total structure, or an actual rejection of some of the ideas it contains, and a desire to diminish the extreme concreteness of its images. Certainly there is here a reveling in materials of magic property, gold, silver, crystal, glass, and above all, light conceived as a liquid element, or as dew, as honey, an element that can be bathed in and gathered into vessels, that has quite largely disappeared from the Silmarillion, although, of course, the idea of light as liquid, dripping down, poured and hoarded, sucked up by Ungoliant, remained essential to the conception of the trees. This idea becomes, in the later writing, less palpable, and the divine operations are given less physical explanation and justification. As a result of this fullness and intensity of description, the origin of the sun and moon in the last fruit and last flower of the trees has less of mystery than in the succinct and beautiful language of the Silmarillion, but also much is said here to emphasize the great size of the fruit of noon and the increase in the heat and brilliance of the sunship after its launching, so that the reflection rises less readily than if the sun that brilliantly illumines the whole earth was but one fruit of laurelin, then Valinor must have been painfully bright and hot in the days of the trees. In the early story, the last outpourings of life from the dying trees are utterly strange and enormous, those of laurelin portentous, even ominous. The sun is astoundingly bright and hot even to the Valar, who are awestruck and disquieted by what has been done. The gods knew that they had done a greater thing than they at first knew, and the anger and distress of certain of the Valar at the burning light of the sun enforces the feeling that in the last fruit of laurelin a terrible and unforeseen power has been released. This distress does indeed survive in the Silmarillion, page 100, in the reference to the prayers of Lorien and Este, who said that sleep and rest had been banished from the earth, and the stars were hidden. But in the tale, the blasting power of the new sun is intensely conveyed in the images of the heat dancing above the trees, in the gardens of Lorien, the silent nightingales, the withered poppies, and the drooping evening flowers. In the old story there is a mythical explanation of the moon's phases, though not of eclipses, and of the markings on its face through the story of the breaking of the withered bough of Silpion and the fall of the moonflower, a story altogether at variance with the explanation given in the Silmarillion, page 100. In the tale, the fruit of laurelin also fell to the ground when Aule stumbled and its weight was too great for Tulkas to bear alone. The significance of this event is not made perfectly clear, but it seems that had the fruit of noon not burst asunder, Aule would not have understood its structure and conceived that of the sunship. To whatever extent the great differences between the versions in this part of the mythology may be due to later compression, there remain a good many actual contradictions, of which I note here only some of the more important, in addition to that concerning the markings on the moon already mentioned. Thus, in the Silmarillion, the moon rose first, and was the elder of the new lights, as was Telperion of the trees in the same place. In the old story, the reverse is true both of the trees and of the new lights. Again, in the Silmarillion, it is Varda who decides their motions, and she changes these from her first plan at the plea of Lorien and Este, whereas here it is Lorien's very distress at the coming of sunlight that leads to the last blossoming of Silpion and the making of the moon. The Valar indeed play different roles throughout, and here far greater importance attaches to the acts of Vana and Lorien, whose relations with the sun and moon are at once deeper and more explicit than they afterwards became, as they had been with the trees. See The Coming of the Valar, side 3. In the Silmarillion it was Nianna who watered the trees with her tears, page 98. In the Silmarillion, the sun and moon move nearer to Arda than the ancient stars, page 99, but here they move at quite different levels in the firmament. But a feature in which later compression can be certainly discerned is the elaborate description in the tale of the moon as an island of pure glass, a shimmering isle with little lakes of the light from Telimpe bordered with shining flowers, and a crystalline cup amidmost in which was set the moonflower. Only from this is explicable the reference in the Silmarillion to Tilion's steering the island of the moon. The aged elf Uolekuvian, whom some indeed have named the man in the moon, seems almost to have strayed in from another conception. His presence gives difficulty in any case, since we have just been told that Silmo could not sail in the moonship because he was not of the children of the air, and could not cleanse his being of its earthwardness. An isolated heading, Uole and Erinti, in the little pocketbook used, among things, for suggestions of stories to be told, see The Flight of the Noldoli, side 6, no doubt implies that a tale was preparing on the subject of Uole. Compare the tale of Corinomi concerning Urwendi and Erinti's brother, Fionwe. The Hiding of Valinor, side 8. No traces of these tales are to be found, and they were presumably never written. Another note in the pocketbook calls Uole Mikumi the earlier name of Uole Kuvion, King of the Moon, and a third refers to a poem, The Man in the Moon, which is to be sung by Ariel, who says that he will sing them a song of a legend touching Uole Mikumi as men have it. My father wrote a poem about The Man in the Moon in March 1915, but if it was this that he was thinking of including, it would have startled the company of Mar Vanwa Chalieva, and he would have had to change its references to places in England which were not yet in existence. Although it is very probable that he had something quite different in mind, I think it may be of interest to give this poem in an early form. As the mythology evolved and changed, the making of the sun and moon became the element of greatest difficulty, and in the published Silmarillion this chapter does not seem of a piece with much of the rest of the work, and could not be made to be so. Towards the end of his life, my father was indeed prepared to dismantle much of what he had built in the attempt to solve what he undoubtedly felt to be a fundamental problem. Note on the order of the tales. The development of the lost tales is here, in fact, extremely complex. After the concluding words of The Flight of the Noldoli, the story of the darkening of Valinor was at an end. Side 6, my father wrote, see on Beyond in other books, but in fact, he added subsequently the short dialogue between Lindo and Ariel, great was the power of Melko for ill, which is given at the end of The Flight of the Noldoli. The page numbering of the notebooks shows that the next tale was to be the tale of Tinuviel, which is written in another book. This long story, to be given in part 2, the oldest extant version of Beren and Luthien, begins with a long link passage. And the curious thing is that this link begins with the very dialogue between Lindo and Ariel just referred to, in almost identical wording, and this can be seen to be its original place. But here it was struck through. I have mentioned earlier, The Music of the Ainur, side 2, that in a letter written by my father in 1964, he said that he wrote The Music of the Ainur while working in Oxford on the staff of the dictionary, a post that he took up in November 1918 and relinquished in the spring of 1920. In the same letter, he said that he wrote The Fall of Gondolin during sick leave from the army in 1917, and the original version of the tale of Luthien, Tinuviel, and Beren later in the same year. There is nothing in the manuscripts to suggest that the tales that follow The Music of the Ainur to the point we have now reached were not written consecutively and continuously from the music while my father was still in Oxford. At first sight, then, there is a hopeless contradiction in the evidence, for the link in question refers explicitly to the darkening of Valinor, a tale written after his appointment in Oxford at the end of 1918, but is a link to the tale of Tinuviel, which he said that he wrote in 1917. But the tale of Tinuviel and the link that precedes it is in fact a text in ink written over an erased, penciled original. It is, I think, certain that this rewriting of Tinuviel was considerably later. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 8. The Book of Lost Tales, part 1, continuing with the Tale of the Sun and Moon on page 203. It was linked to The Flight of the Noldoli by the speeches of Lindo and Ariel. The link passage is integral and continuous with the tale of Tinuviel that follows it, and was not added afterwards. At this stage, my father must have felt that the tales need not necessarily be told in the actual sequence of the narrative, for Tinuviel belongs, of course, to the time after the making of the sun and moon. The rewritten Tinuviel, was followed, with no break, by a first form of the interlude introducing Gylfanon of Tavrobel as a guest in the house, and this led into the tale of the sun and moon. But subsequently, my father changed his mind, and so struck out the dialogue of Lindo and Ariel from the beginning of the link to Tinuviel, which was not now to follow the flight of the Noldoli, and wrote it out again in the other book at the end of that tale. At the same time, he rewrote the Gylfanon interlude in an extended form, and placed it at the end of the flight of the Noldoli. Thus, old form, flight of the Noldoli, words of Lindo and Ariel, tale of Tinuviel, Gylfanon interlude, tale of the sun and moon and the hiding of Valinor. Later form, flight of the Noldoli, words of Lindo and Ariel, Gylfanon interlude, rewritten, tale of the sun and moon and the hiding of Valinor. That the rewriting of Tinuviel was one of the latest elements in the composition of the Lost Tales seems clear from the fact that it is followed by the first form of the Gylfanon interlude, written at the same time, for Gylfanon replaced Ilios, and Ilios, not Gylfanon, is the guest in the house in the earlier versions of the Tale of the Sun and Moon and the Hiding of Valinor, and is the teller of the tale of the Naglfring. The poem about the man in the moon exists in many texts, and was published at Leeds in 1923. Footnote, A Northern Venture, verses by members of the Leeds University English School Association, Leeds, at the Swan Press, 1923. I have not seen this publication and take these details from Humphrey Carpenter, Biography, page 269, end of footnote. Long after, and much changed, it was included in The Adventures of Tom Bombadil, 1962. I give it here in the earlier published form, which was only a little retouched from the earliest workings, where it has the title, Why the Man in the Moon Came Down Too Soon, an East Anglian Fantasy. In the first finished text, the title is A Fairy, Why the Man in the Moon Came Down Too Soon, together with one in Old English, Se Mon Kining. Why the Man in the Moon Came Down Too Soon. The man in the moon had silver shoon, and his beard was of silver thread. He was girt with pale gold, and inaureoled with gold about his head. Clad in silken robe, in his great white globe, he opened an ivory door with a crystal key, and in secrecy he stole o'er a shadowy floor. Down a filigree stair of spidery hair he slipped in gleaming haste, and laughing with glee to be merry and free, he swiftly earthward raced. He was tired of his pearls and diamond twirls, of his pallid minaret, dizzy and white at its lunar height, in a world of silver set. And adventured this peril for ruby and beryl, and emerald and sapphire, and all lustrous gems for new diadems, or to blazon his pale attire. He was lonely, too, with nothing to do but to stare at the golden world, or strain for the hum that would distantly come as it gaily passed him whirled. And at Plenilune, in his argent moon, he had wearily longed for fire, not the limpid lights of wan Selenites, but a red terrestrial pyre, with imperturate glows of crimson and rose, and leaping orange tongue, for great seas of blues and the passionate hues, when a dancing dawn is young. For the meadowy ways, like chrysoprase, by winding yar and nen, how he longed for the mirth of the populous earth, and the sanguine blood of men. And coveted song, and laughter long, and viands hot and wine, eating pearly cakes of light snowflakes, and drinking thin moonshine. He twinkled his feet as he thought of the meat, of the punch and the peppery brew, till he tripped unaware on his slanting stair, and fell like meteors do. As the whickering sparks in splashing arcs of stars blown down like rain, from his laddery path took a foaming bath in the ocean of Almain. And began to think, lest he melt and stink, what in the moon to do, when a Yarmouth boat found him far afloat, to the amazement of the crew, caught in their net all shimmering wet, in a phosphorescent sheen of bluey whites and opal lights and delicate liquid green. With the morning fish, 'twas his regal wish, they packed him to Norwich town, to get warm on gin in a Norfolk inn, and dry his watery gown. though St. Peter's knell waked many a bell in the city's ringing towers, to shout the news of his lunatic cruise in the early morning hours. No hearths were laid, not a breakfast made, and no one would sell him gems. He found ashes for fire, and his gay desire for chorus and brave anthems met snores instead with all Norfolk abed, and his round heart nearly broke, more empty and cold than above of old, till he bartered his fairy cloak, with a half-waked cook for a kitchen nook, and his belt of gold for a smile, and a priceless jewel for a bowl of gruel, a sample cold and vile of the proud plum porridge of Anglian Norwich. He arrived so much too soon for unusual guests on adventurous quests from the mountains of the moon. It seems very possible that the pallid minaret reappears in the little white turret which Wole Kuvion built on the moon, where often he climbs and watches the heavens or the world beneath. The minaret of the man in the moon survives in the final version. The ocean of Almaine is the North Sea. Almaine or Almany was a name of Germany in earlier English. The Yar is a Norfolk river which falls into the sea at Yarmouth, and the Nen, pronounced also with a short vowel, flows into the Wash. 9. The Hiding of Valinor. Introduction. The link to this tale, which is told by Vire, has been given at the end of the last, side 7. The manuscript continues as in the latter part of the tale of the Sun and Moon, see side 7, note 19, with an earlier draft also extant, to which reference is made in the notes. The Hiding of Valinor. Lo, tales I tell of the deep days, and the first is called The Hiding of Valinor. Already have ye heard, said she, of the setting forth of the Sun and Moon upon their wayward journeyings, and many things are there to tell concerning the awakening of the earth beneath their light. But hear now of the thoughts and deeds of the dwellers in Valinor in those mighty days. Now is it to tell that so wide were the wanderings of those boats of light, that the gods found it no easy thing to govern all their comings and their goings, as they had purposed at the first. And Ilinsor was loath to yield the heaven to Urwendi, and Urwendi set sail often before Ilinsor's due return, being eager and hot of mood. Wherefore were both vessels often far afloat at one and the same time, and the glory of them sailing most nigh to the very bosom of the earth, as often they did at that time, was very great and very terrible to see. Then did a vague uneasiness begin to stir anew in Valinor, and the hearts of the gods were troubled, and the Eldar spake one to another, and this was their thought. Lo, all the world is grown clear as the courtyards of the gods, straight to walk upon as are the avenues of Vansa Mirin, or the terraces of Kor, and Valinor no longer is safe, for Melko hates us without ceasing, and he holds the world without, and many and wild are his allies there. And herein in their hearts they, note one, numbered even the Noldoli, and wronged them in their thought unwittingly, nor did they forget men, against whom Melko had lied of old. Indeed, in the joy of the last burgeoning of the trees, and the great and glad labour of that fashioning of ships, the fear of Melko had been laid aside, and the bitterness of those last evil days, and of the gnome folk's flight, was fallen into slumber. But now, when Valinor had peace once more, and its lands and gardens were mended of their hurts, memory awoke their anger and their grief again. Indeed, if the gods forgot not the folly of the Noldoli, and hardened their hearts, yet more wroth were the elves, and the Sulasimpi were full of bitterness against their kin, desiring never more to see their faces in the pathways of their home. Of these, the chief were those whose kin had perished at the haven of the swans, and their leader was one, Ainairos, who had escaped from that fray, leaving his brother dead. And he sought unceasingly with his words to persuade the elves to greater bitterness of heart. Now this was a grief to Manwë, yet did he see that as yet his design was not complete, and that the wisdom of the Valar must needs be bent once more to the more perfect government of the sun and moon. Wherefore he summoned the gods and elves in conclave, that their counsel might better his design, and moreover he hoped with soft words of wisdom to calm their anger and uneasiness ere evil came of it. For clearly he saw herein the poison of Melko's lies, that live and multiply wherever he may cast them, more fruitfully than any seed that is sown upon the earth. And already it was reported to him that the ancient murmuring of the elves was begun anew concerning their freedom, and that pride made some full of folly, so that they might not endure the thought of the coming of mankind. Now then sat Manwë in heavy mood before Cwllwlyn, and looked searchingly upon the Valar gathered nigh, and upon the Eldar about his knees. But he opened not his full mind, saying to them only that he had called them in council once more to determine the courses of the sun and moon, and devise an order and wisdom in their paths. Then straightway spake Aenyros before him, saying that other matters were deeper in their hearts than this, and he laid before the gods the mind of the elves concerning the Noldoli, and of the nakedness of the land of Valinor toward the world beyond. Thereat arose much tumult, and many of the Valar and their folk supported him loudly, and some others of the Eldar cried out that Manwë and Varda had caused their kindred to dwell in Valinor, promising them unfailing joy therein. Now let the gods see to it that their gladness was not minished to a little thing, seeing that Melko held the world, and they dared not fare forth to the places of their awakening, even an they would. The most of the Valar, moreover, were fain of their ancient ease, and desired only peace, wishing neither rumour of Melko and his violence, nor murmur of the restless gnomes to come ever again among them, to disturb their happiness. And for such reasons they also clamoured for the concealment of the land. Not the least among these were Vana and Nessa, albeit most even of the great gods were of one mind. In vain did Ulmo of his foreknowing plead before them for pity and pardon on the Noldoli, or Manwë unfold the secrets of the music of the Ainur and the purpose of the world. And long and very full of that noise was that council, and more filled with bitterness and burning words than any that had been. Wherefore did Manwë Sulimo depart at length from among them, saying that no walls or bulwarks might now offend Melko's evil from them, which lived already among them and clouded all their minds. So came it that the enemies of the gnomes carried the counsel of the gods, and the blood of Kopas began already its fell work, for now began that which is named the hiding of Valinor, and Manwë and Varda and Ulmo of the seas had no part therein, but none others of the Valar or the elves held aloof therefrom, albeit Yavanna and Orome her son were uneasy in their hearts. Now Lorien and Vana led the gods, and Aule lent his skill and Tulkas his strength, and the Valar went not at that time forth to conquer Melko, and the greatest ruth was that to them thereafter, and yet is, for the great glory of the Valar by reason of that error came not to its fullness in many ages of the earth, and still doth the world await it. Note 2. In those days, however, they were unwitting of these things, and they set them to new and mighty labours, such as had not been seen among them since the days of the first building of Valinor. The encircling mountains did they make more utterly impassable of their eastern side than ever were they before, and such earth magics did Kemi weave about their precipices and inaccessible peaks, that of all the dread and terrible places in the mighty earth was that rampart of the gods that looked upon Eruman the most dire and perilous, and not Utumna nor the places of Melko in the hills of Iron were so filled with insuperable fear. Moreover, even upon the plains about their eastward edge, note 3, were heaped those impenetrable webs of clinging dark that Ungueliante sloughed in Valinor at the trees destroying. Now did the gods cast them forth from their bright land, that they might entangle utterly the steps of all who fared that way, and they flowed and spread both far and wide, lying even upon the bosom of the shadowy seas, until the bay of Faerie grew dim, and no radiance of Valinor filtered there, and the twinkling of the lamps of Kor died or ever it passed the jewelled shores. From north to south marched the enchantment and inaccessible magic of the gods. Yet were they not content, and they said, "Behold, we will cause all the paths that fare to Valinor, both known and secret, to fade utterly from the world, or wander treacherously into blind confusion." This then they did, and no channel in the seas was left that was not beset with perilous eddies, or with streams of overmastering strength, for the confusion of all ships. And spirits of sudden storms and winds unlooked for brooded there by Ossie's will, and others of inextricable mist. Neither did they forget even the long circuitous ways that messengers of the gods had known and followed through the dark wildernesses of the north and the deepest south. And when all was done to their mind, Lorien said, "Now doth Valinor stand alone, and we have peace." And Varna sang once more about her garden in the lightness of her heart. Alone among all did the hearts of the Solus Impi misgive them, and they stood upon the coasts, nigh to their ancient homes, and laughter came not easily again amongst them. And they looked upon the sea, and despite its peril and its gloom, they feared it lest it still might bring evil into the land. Then did some of them, going, speak to Aule and to Tulkas, who stood nigh, saying, "O great ones of the Valar, full well and wondrously have the gods laboured, yet do we think in our hearts that something is yet lacking. For we have not heard that the way of the escape of the Noldoli, even the dread passage of Helcarax's cliffs, is destroyed. Yet where the children of the Eldar have trodden, so may the sons of Melko return, despite all your enchantments and deceits. Neither are we in peace at heart, by reason of the undefended sea." Thereat did Tulkas laugh, saying that naught might come now to Valinor, save only by the topmost heirs, and Melko hath no power there, neither have ye, O little ones of the earth. Nonetheless, at Aule's bidding, he fared with that Vala to the bitter places of the sorrow of the gnomes, and Aule, with the mighty hammer of his forge, smote that wall of jagged ice, and when it was cloven even to the chill waters, Tulkas rent it asunder with his great hands, and the seas roared in between, and the land of the gods was sundered utterly from the realms of earth. Note 4. This did they at the shoreland elves behest, yet by no means would the gods suffer that low place in the hills beneath Taniquetil that lets upon the bay of Faerie to be piled with rocks, as the Solus Impi desired, for there had Orome many pleasant woods and places of delight, and the Teleri, note 5, would not endure that Kor should be destroyed or pressed too nearly by the gloomy mountain walls. Then spake the Solus Impi to Ulmo, and he would not listen to them, saying that never had they learnt such bitterness of heart of his music, and that rather had they been listening to whispers of Melko the accursed. And going from Ulmo some were abashed, but others went and sought out Ossie, and he aided them in Ulmo's despite. And of Ossie's labour in those days are come the magic isles, for Ossie set them in a great ring about the western limits of the mighty sea, so that they guarded the bay of Faerie, and albeit in those days the huge glooms of that far water overreached all the shadowy seas, and stretched forth tongues of darkness towards them, still were they themselves surpassing fair to look upon. And such ships as fare that way must needs espy them, or ever they reach the last waters that wash the elfin shores. And so alluring were they that few had power to pass them by, and did any essay to, then sudden storms drove them perforce against those beaches whose pebbles shone like silver and like gold. Yet all such as stepped thereon came never thence again, but being woven in the nets of Oinen's, note 6, hair, the lady of the sea, and whelmed in age-long slumber that Lorien set there, lay upon the margin of the waves, as those do who, being drowned, are cast up once more by the movements of the sea. Yet rather did these hapless ones sleep unfathomably, and the dark waters laved their limbs, but their ships rotted, swathed in weeds, on those enchanted sands, and sailed nevermore before the winds of the dim west.